From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, a discussion on why Satanism is growing in popularity. Maybe we can slow that down. Here's what's happening. The Obama administration is pressing ahead with its version of building a national rail network when it's calling now for a $53 billion plan of a passenger train with a high-speed rail project over the next 6 years. They're really excited about this. The proposal made by Vice President Joseph Biden in Philadelphia would move the country closer to the president's goal of making high-speed rail accessible to 80% of Americans within 25 years. And the administration's investigation into Toyota safety problems found no electronic flaws to account for reports of sudden unintentional acceleration and other safety problems. Government investigators said the only known cause of the problems are mechanical defects that were fixed in previous recalls. A young Google executive who helped ignite Egypt's uprising energized a cheering crowd of hundreds of thousands with his first appearance in their midst after being released 12 days from being in a secret detention. With protests invigorated, Vice President Omar Suleiman issued a sharply worded warning saying, "We can't bear this for too much longer. There must be an end to this crisis as soon as possible. It is a growing sign of impatience with 16 days of mass demonstrations." Jerry Carsey on the line with us now, writes for WorldNet Daily and also Red Alert, his newsletter. Jerry, I fear that this statement means they may get tough militarily. What do you think?
I think that's very likely, George. The Middle East was shocked also by revelations that Mubarak may have as much as $70 billion stashed away in Swiss bank accounts, other foreign bank accounts, shadowy real estate holdings in Manhattan, London, Rodeo Drive, and Beverly Hills. I mean, this would make Mubarak the richest man in the world, and much of the money was stolen out of U.S. aid and other funds from the Egyptian people. The Mubarak government will not be able to long last these kinds of revelations, and the crowds in Tahrir Square are building day by day.
Can we ever get the money back from him?
Oh, I doubt it very much, George.
All gone somewhere.
It's all gone somewhere. I mean, even tracing it is going to be very difficult, but it's a real insult to the Egyptian people, and it again makes a mockery of U.S. foreign aid. That was meant to go to other purposes, not to enrich a dictator. The Mubarak government, I think, is going to have a very difficult time sustaining it until September. The problem is this Muslim Brotherhood is really on the rise, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the more people should look into it, realize that it's a very radical organization. It's been banned in Egypt. And if the Muslim Brotherhood comes out of this with a place in the newly formed government, I think it means that Egypt, which has been a really kind of a bedrock of peace in the Middle East, could become radicalized and could be much more dangerous for Israel.
Okay, we'll monitor that situation. Scientists believe that they have discovered the genetic code that makes some people sleepwalk. By studying four generations of a family of sleepwalkers, they trace the fault to a section of chromosome 20. Carrying even one copy of the defective DNA is enough to cause sleepwalking, they say. They hope to target genes involved and find new treatments for the condition that affects up to 10% of children and 1 in 50 adults. Well, there's more bad news in the cards for Romania's witches. A month after Romanian authorities began taxing them for their trade, the country's soothsayers and fortune tellers are cursing a new bill that threatens fines or even prison if their predictions don't come true. Superstition is a serious matter in the land of Dracula, and officials have turned to witches to help the recession-hit country collect more money and crack down on tax evasion. Well, Fiona Horn is an expert, leading expert on modern-day witchcraft. Let's check in with her on this. Taxing them because their predictions don't come true? Unbelievable.
Well, I think taxing is okay in general because, you know, it's a job, they earn income, whatever, taxing, fine. But being fined and possibly going to jail for predictions not coming true is outrageous. I mean, here's an analogy. Does a weatherman get fined when he gets the forecast wrong. I mean, seriously, when I do readings, because I read the cards and I do psychic prediction work as well, I, to the best of my ability, take in all the prevailing influences as I perceive them, and then to the best of my ability, I predict what's most likely going to happen given the current prevailing influences. But I always emphasise to my clients that the future is created by the steps we take today. And seriously, sometimes in a very volatile situation, trying to predict what's going to happen is like trying to predict which way a leaf's going to blow in a hurricane. You know, it can be very volatile.
Sure.
But, you know, to find the Romanian witches and then put them in prison because their predictions don't become true, well, then lock up every weatherman, lock up every surgeon that says he can perform a successful operation. I mean, you know, you go to hospital, you have to sign a piece of paper saying, I understand that there's no guarantee this surgery is going to work.
I've heard some crazy bills and laws before, Fiona, but this one takes the cake.
I really think it takes the cake. Look, I'm cool with taxing. It is what it is. I pay taxes. You know, if I do a reading and I earn income from it, I pay taxes on
it.
I declare the income. It is what it is. You know, we always say in witchcraft, you cross the palm with silver. I've done a lot of charity work. I've done a lot of free stuff, a lot of stuff just to help others. But, you know, you have to eat. You have to pay your rent. You have to put food on the table. You have to sometimes charge for your services. Paying tax is fair enough. But being fined and sent to jail for predictions not coming true is truly outrageous. And, you know, anyone listening out there, you know, if you're going to a psychic or you're getting predictions, remember your future is created by the steps you take today. The best service a psychic can give is tell you, you know, if you keep continuing in that direction, I predict something possibly that you don't like could happen. So let's change that. Let's change those steps and send you off in a better direction. And that's where the real service of a psychic and a soothsayer comes in. You know, it's guidance.
All right.
They should not be penalized for getting things wrong.
Fiona Horn's website is linked up with our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Fiona, thank you so much. A Chance Discovery in 1985 leads historical researcher Ron Pastore on an adventure into the life and death of Jesse James. But it's much more than that. What about Jesse James' hidden treasure? What about his secrets? That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And this is going to be a fantastic hour. Ron Pastore has done extensive research into Native American cultures and ceremonial sites. He leads a team of researchers with expertise in a wide array of specialized technical fields. His book, Jesse James' Secret, as we talk about codes, cover-ups, and hidden treasure. Here's Ron Pastore on Coast to Coast. Ron, how are you?
I'm great, George. Thank you. It's an honor to be on with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for sending us your work. When we saw that, we jumped all over it.
No doubt. It was just days ago.
You know, I live in St. Louis. It's in Missouri, and old Jesse James was born out in that state a long time ago.
Yeah, he's got a lot of footprints throughout your area. In your city.
Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, you know, popular legend has him as more of a victim of his times. He was a farm boy plowing the fields when he was 14 years old, and the federal troops came in and lassoed him around the neck and horsewhipped him and wanted him to confess where his brother was, and he just wouldn't give it up. You know, and this kind of victimization led him to ultimately join the Confederate forces and, you know, be a tremendous warrior for the cause. And in time, when the war ended, he tried to surrender, and he was unable to. He was so hated. You know, they even shot him when he rode in and tried to surrender. So more of a victim of his times, I would put him.
What got you on the Jesse James trail?
Oh, that was kind of a long path. I tell you, I was running an archaeological dig out in Butler County, Kansas, at a cave site. And a man came by one day and asked if we had any Jesse James initials in the cave. And I said, well, yeah, in fact, we do. And got some information out of him about what those initials might be. A couple of years later, I was doing the documentary on the Native American burial mounds, and the producer had asked me if I knew of any other interesting stories, and just happened to mention Jesse James, and he was really intrigued by the thought that the man may have faked his death. So he put me in touch with a publisher, John Woods, who ultimately became my co-author on this book, Jesse James' Secret.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to do a draft, 10 pages, 20 pages, 100 pages. Next thing you know, we got a 300-page book.
Why would he fake his death? To hide?
Well, you know, he'd been pursued for 17 years. I think there were a lot of other factors going on, that maybe he wasn't the only guy robbing banks and trains and stagecoaches under the name Jesse James, and he wanted to escape his past. So there was an attempt a year earlier to do it, and the word got out that it was a ruse, and so they were a little more organized about it the second time in St. Joe, Missouri, and put together a plot that worked.
He would hit trains a lot, wouldn't he and his gang?
I actually find there are three M.O.s, a train robber, a bank robber, and a stagecoach robber, and each has a different description. So that was one of the clues that led me to unfold this story.
Is it true that when he jumped on a train to rob it, he would not rob from a working man, only from some elitist?
Right. Yeah, he would go so far even to check a man's hands to see if they were calloused, you know. And if somebody had taken something from him, he'd give it back. But on the other hand, you know, the wealthy had to pay.
Is that true?
I find it is, yeah. He was kind of a Robin Hood.
And he takes his money. What does he do with it?
Well, there's a lot of contention about that, but what I found primarily on the larger robberies is that they already had a stash, a cash place to put the stuff before they robbed the bank or train or whatever it happened to be, and stashed it so they could ride away unencumbered. And these caches are all over the country. You know, surely they took some pocket money along, but if you've got a big, heavy sack of gold, you're not going to get away with that too fast.
Was he stealing for the Confederates at all?
Yeah, I believe there was a bigger plot here, a larger organization. I mean, there was huge robberies, like the St. Louis Federal Reserve got taken for, I think it was $400 million, and there was just huge robberies all around the country that were probably operated through a clandestine society.
And where's the money now?
Well, I think a lot of it's still out there, George.
Hidden away?
Yeah, in these organized, very well-done caches that were put together by Masons with their skills and a tremendous coding system and a specialized mapping system. And, you know, it's traceable. I mean, we have found evidence of that.
I mean, are they like, is it buried or they're put, like you just mentioned, masonry? So they, have they built like small little edifices? They put them in, put the gold in and covered it up with brick and stuff?
Yeah, I find in some of my research where they would go file a mining claim and bring in the miners. First the engineers, then the miners, hustle those guys off, and they'd bring in some masons, and they'd build the vault, and they send those guys away, and then the treasure train would arrive. They'd offload, fill the vault up, and seal it up, and conceal the entrance, and nobody would ever know.
How many of them are there out there, do you think?
Well, a speculation between 300 and 500 of the larger caches that are related to the Confederate treasury at the end of the Civil War.
Are they primarily in Missouri?
Oh, all over the country, George. Research shows that it could be in pretty much every state in the Union.
Would it be like in the woods or somewhere like that?
Well, caves and canyons. And
so not obvious places.
No, very remote locations. In fact, that's how I got onto one of the sites that I'm working at.
Now, the site that you found, did you stumble across it?
In a manner of speaking, I mean, I met this family, the descendants of the people that claim that Jesse James was their grandfather, great-grandfather, and they had discovered these two trunks full of heirlooms and artifacts, and I was fortunate enough to have direct access to this. I went through everything and organized it chronologically, and it told a story of Jesse James' life that went through until his older age. And one of the photos, he's an old man, and barely noticeable in the background, off in the distance, was a cave. And I knew I had seen that somewhere before in a book. So I got with the Geological Survey director, and he helped guide me to a contact who got me to someone else. And then it was just down to shoe leather. Went out and boots on the ground, marched out 25 square miles, and finally found the location.
My, all right, what did you find?
Well, we found a tremendous cave site that was really tucked away in a remote location. And not far from there were seven other caves, and this was in my documentary on the History Channel that just aired again today, Jesse James Hidden Treasure.
Right, that's very good, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. And a two-hour documentary, they did a great job exposing a lot of this material, but there's no way to cover it all in 2 hours, you know. But at any rate, we toured the site, and we found all these cryptic marks and codes and petroglyphs on the walls, and really didn't make a lot out of it. It didn't come to me about the treasures until a few years later. But eventually we got permission to work the site and do the research and do some excavating, and we found some small caches so far, but not the big mother load. We're onto it. We think we're going to have one soon, and we'll keep everyone posted.
Now, when you say small, how small?
Oh, just a gold bar and a jar full of silver dollars and gold coins. You know, nothing.
Oh, a gold bar's worth a lot these days.
Yeah, a smaller Dory bar, not a huge one, you know. But and it certainly doesn't justify the budgets we put into the research.
All right, let me figure this out. How many ounces would that be?
It's about 7.5.
7.5 ounces at $13.50. So it's almost 10 grand.
Sure. And, you know, that would.
Yeah, over that.
Buy a piece of equipment or fund us for a few months or something along that line, but you don't sell that. It's an artifact, and it'll be held onto for a museum exhibit.
So if you found a cave with zillions of these things, it's worth a fortune.
Now we're talking.
But they could be all over the place. If there are that many,
yes,
we're talking about how much in today's dollars. What do you think?
$1.3
trillion. What? That's not even going to scratch our debt, but that's not bad, huh?
Yeah. I think creative management, you could pay the interest on the debt.
Yeah, you could. You could be your own financier. You'd be like the Chinese.
Yeah, there we go, because they're dropping us.
Why isn't anybody, Ron, making a concerted effort to try to find these places, or are they, and it's just very quiet?
Yeah, I think it's very quiet. There's a small group of people who do invest themselves in trying to locate these. I think a few of them have been found in the past, and maybe they didn't go public with it. We just thought it was a tremendously fascinating story and that the public should know and that we could share this.
That's a great... No, but they're not all Jesse James's caches, are they?
No, I see it more as the Confederacy had all this loot. A lot of it did come out of the northern industrialists and people who wanted to support the South, even European financiers, and they didn't want to give it back to the Union at the end of the Civil War. So this Confederate money was given to Jesse and the Knights of the Golden Circle to conceal and forever put it away.
So if one is walking somewhere in a cave in the forest and sees a bizarre-looking what would they be able to conclude?
Well, I think if you saw petroglyphs marked on the wall, Jesse has a fairly common JJ insignia, but there's also back-to-back J's that look like an anchor and sun signs, just a turkey's foot, like a wild turkey you would see in the dirt out in the wilderness. You know, if that peace sign without the circle around it, it indicates treasure, buried treasure. And I'm not saying just Jesse James. I mean, there are Spanish hoards out there and French hoards. I mean, there's all kinds of treasures buried out there. If you do the least bit of research, you'll find that every state in the country has at least 1,000 to 1,200 treasure legends tied to it.
And there's some maps?
Lots of maps. Lots of fake stuff, too.
Ah.
But, for example, there is one called the Wolf Map or the Cement Map, and it's got an eagle and a wolf on it. And we happened to find both those glyphs on our cave in a direct north-south alignment. So it told us we were onto the right path.
That's an amazing story.
Thanks, George.
And do you get to keep all the stuff that you find?
Well, we have agreements with the landowners that vary from site to site. And, ours isn't the financial motivation. We spend more money than we'll ever make on this thing doing the research, but it's a fantastic adventure, an exciting lifestyle, and my team all loves doing this. They all volunteer, and it's a great group of trusted guys, law enforcement, private detectives, security officers, so everyone is a good longtime friend, but also in a trusted career path.
Hey, I understand you're doing a web TV show with a dear friend of ours, Cheryl Jones, former CNN anchor.
I love Cheryl. We're working together on developing a web TV show because so many people have asked after the documentary what's going on with that site, what's happening next. And so we thought, well, instead of having to tune in to a cable channel at a specific time and then only catch it once, we'd put something on the Internet where it'd be there 24/7. And the working name right now is NGSTV. Out of our group, National Geomantic Survey. And so it'll be ngstv.com.
I go back with her so long, and she looks the same way as she did then.
And she's still a powerhouse.
I tried to get her hired when she was a weather forecaster in Kansas City, Missouri.
Right.
I mean, that goes way back.
That's where we met some time back, you bet. Great
now,
lady.
Now, this fascinates me, this treasure hunt. But at the same time, the story of Jesse James fascinates me. I want to talk with you a little bit about that when we come back. So you're saying Bob Ford, who was hiding away in his house with Jesse, who apparently was supposed to have shot him in the back of the head, didn't do that?
It's completely fabricated. There is no evidence to support the popular myth of how Jesse James died.
All right. Well, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines as well as we talk with Ron Pastore. His work, Jesse James' Secret, his website, jessejamesforensics.com. Fascinating story of hidden treasure all around the United States. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment. And if you need to email me, that's George at coasttocoastam.com. Let's flip a switch. The phone lines are now open. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls. Actually, in just a moment, we'll take your phone calls with Ron Pastore. But next hour, we're going to be talking with a Satanist. Now, God forsakes, we're not supporting Satan. I've been getting a lot of emails from people that think, what's going on? But I want you to be aware of what's going on out there. But we'll come back in a moment. We'll take your calls with Ron Pastore on Coast to Coast AM. Ron, what has made you conclude that it's possible that Jesse James faked his death?
Gosh, George, you know, there's so much evidence to support that contention. It starts with the deed itself. Bob Ford testifies that he took this brand-new .44 caliber weapon that Jesse just gave him as a gift and fired it point-blank at the back of the man's head and alleged that the bullet exited the temple. And when you look at the death photo, which Tommy was good enough to post on your website, there's no exit wound. It's the impression of a trigger hammer. And you know, nothing in the death photo supports that that's Jesse James. The newspaper says his right index finger is missing the tip of it, but it's there in the photo. Instead, it's the thumb that was severed, and he's bruised around the finger like he had a weapon taken out of his hand in combat. There's alleges that Bob shot him once in the back of the head, but there's four fresh bullet holes in the body in the autopsy. The biggest joke I find is that they say that the corpse had an abscess in the groin, and Jesse James' abscess was in his lower front jaw.
A big difference.
Quite a tough.
Well, who's the victim?
Well, I contend that it's his cousin. There were. It takes a lot to wrap your mind around the legend of Jesse James. And to me, there was so much dissimilarity in photographs and the MO and the descriptions. It wound up taking three people to make this composite of this person.
Did he bump off the cousin just so he could hide?
I think there was a little more to it. I think he was a brutal, mean guy, and he wasn't on the inside of this Knights of the Golden Circle organization. And finally, they green-lighted getting rid of him with the help of the governor and the sheriff and a whole cast of players.
And off went the cousin.
That's it. And the autopsy says that the body had 12 to 14 hours rigor mortis. So they didn't just kill him that morning. They bushwhacked him out in the barn the night before, got him out there.
All right. If he lived a long life, how old do you think he would have been, and what year would he have passed on?
Well, this is where it turns out it's really a love story, not a brutal villain story. He lived to 88 years old. He had eight children. And the reason he died in 1935 was because on Christmas of 1934, his wife died unexpectedly. I think it was a heart attack. And he was so heartbroken, he went to bed and refused to eat and drink. And he died of a broken heart 5-6 weeks later.
My ex-wife, her family, their name was James.
Uh-huh.
They lived down that way. Oh. Don't tell me. Don't tell me it's them.
That would be interesting. I'll talk to you more about that.
I've got to check into that. All right, let's go to the phones. Tom in Boston, Massachusetts, you're up with us. Hey, Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Great show, George. Ron, you know what really, that trillion-dollar number that you mentioned, that really opened my eyes late at night here.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that I know George talks about at Coast, it comes up in a variety of different topics, is these European kind of power brokers and money masters, like the Rothschilds, I guess at that time their agent August Belmont in New York, and maybe down south somebody like Judah Benjamin, who actually fled to London after the Civil War. So I just wondered, you mentioned about those power brokers wanting to send the gold to the south. If you could talk a little bit more about who they were and what they did, and I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks
all right,
so much.
Thank you, Tom. Go ahead, Ryan.
Well, sure. There's a lot of information out there. After the Civil War, Congress conducted an investigation that yielded three 36-volume sets of investigative material. And you can look that up on books.google and actually search the documents for Knights of the Golden Circle and this sort of thing. So, and that was sealed for 75 years. Congress didn't want anyone knowing the complexity and the complicity of all the people that were involved in this. And we're talking about seated governors and adjutant generals in the North. A lot of the funding came from the North, from Canada, from Europe. there's a two-volume set by Bullock that talks about how the European crowns and ruling families of Europe funded the Civil War for the South. I mean, you got to wonder how they had a navy when there were no shipyards in the South.
Good point. Hey, tell me about this facial recognition software analysis.
Sure. I contacted Bob Schmidt when he was with Visage, a division of General Electric that was doing facial recognition software analysis. And he volunteered to do the study on the Jesse James. So we took the commonly known photograph of Jesse as a 16-year-old in his rebel attire. Everyone knows and accepts that's him. And did the analysis with the 80-year-old man that I contend was really Jesse James. And it turns out he was a match. He has a cleft in his brow, a dip in his eyebrow, the drooping eyelid, the dip in the rim of the ears, the large right nostril. All of these markers were present in both characters.
So you would think that might be him.
Absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind. For me, it was a...
That's dramatic.
Sit up in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, wake up and go, oh, my God, the signature matches. I just realized that out of a dream state. And I went and had handwriting analysis done between the two characters, and that was a match.
Okay, next up, let's go to Loveland, Ohio. Russ, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, how you doing tonight, George?
Good, thank you.
Long-time listener. I've talked to you quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a question for your guest. A long time ago, I'm like 62 now, but when I was younger, there was a movie. I don't know who made it, but it was called The Legend of Jesse James. And I remember at the end that he had taken on the identity of a man by the name of Howard. And at the way that it ended, he got shot, and at the end of the movie, they were singing, and the man that day shot Mr. Howard and put poor Jesse in his grave. And I wonder if your guest had ever seen or heard that movie.
Not familiar with the movie. I'm familiar with the alias. In fact, in the James family collection of heirlooms and artifacts, there was a badge with the number 1,000 on it, and it said Kansas City Police Department. So I called the records division to see if there were any criminal records ever filed on Jesse James, and it was surprising that there weren't. I thought, well, just for the heck of it, let's look into this badge and see, you know, what that yields. And the head of the employment records division sent me a letter stating that Jesse W. James worked for the Kansas City Police Department until 1921, and his partner was a Tom Howard.
That's weird.
Very strange.
That is strange. He kept his same name?
In his life, in southeast Kansas, he lived as J.M. James. And what he did, he took the first name Jeremiah and split it in half, and he went by J-E-R-E, middle name M-I-A-H, Jerry Maya James. So that was his alias. But obviously, he was still an undercover operative, a special police officer, and a railroad agent, and all these things that would have granted him easy access without ever having to buy a ticket to get on a train or, you know, check his horse in the cargo bay or anything. Very clever way to get around incognito.
And he must have. He's had 8 kids. He's got a lot of relatives out here.
Oh, yeah, lots of them. And they're split 3 ways. You know, some of them believe it was Jesse, some are neutral, and the others are adamantly opposed to it.
Do they know that they're related to him?
Well, the great-grandson who actually knew the man is aware that it was Jesse James. Anyone else removed from it, you know, they just base it on the historical evidence and all the research I was able to compile in my book, Jesse James Secret.
Let's go to San Francisco now, west of the Rockies. Hey, Patricia, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, what a fabulous show. And Ron, such fine research.
Well, thank you.
Wonderful to listen to. I had to call to tell you a little bit of our family history from originally Minnesota. I like to say a horse ride away from Northfield because Jesse James slept in my great-grandmother's woods after they robbed the Northfield Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked my grandfather, well, what did they do when they were out there? He said, oh, we left them alone.
But
they said they could see the fires burn and they knew who it was.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't feel concerned about their own safety, huh?
Oh, no. They didn't want to bother them, but no, they didn't feel worried at all. They just said, oh, yeah, that's, Jesse James was out there. Yeah, they left everybody alone. They left them alone.
Well, you got to remember, he was the son of a preacher, you know, a well-mannered, non-tobacco, non-alcohol guy. And, he tried to live a righteous life the best he could.
Was this a business for him, Ron, robbing? Was that a business? So he... you know, didn't just go break into homes and things. He did the big stuff.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, it had to be part of a larger conspiracy, some organization that he was funding and helping people infiltrate the government and take on positions of authority. You know, there was much more going on behind the scenes.
First-time caller, Tony's in Springfield, Missouri. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Well, good evening. What an excellent show. Hey, quick question before I get to a point here. What year did he supposedly die?
Well, it was supposedly in 1882, but we're saying 1935.
Okay, that confirms my dates is a little bit what I remembered here. My dad has talked to me many times about the James gang, the James brothers and all, and they used to come in and hide out down in Carter County, Missouri, at a little town called Grandin. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was my grandparents actually was where the contact was at. But we had a little different take on this guy. He was kind of considered as a hero. He would bring in stuff, groceries, food. He brought in stuff and was really good to the locals down there when he would come in and hide.
Well, and he knew which side of the bread it was buttered on.
Yeah, somewhere I happen to think my dad had met him, but I reconsider on that. No, my dad's not that old, but he got that from my grandparents. That's where that came from, that he was really good to the kids and the people down there. He's a very friendly, well-mannered guy.
Yeah.
And he did hide a treasure down there that was in a cave, and the legend was is that it was covered with rocks and leaves and everything, and it was hid. And the whereabouts of it was supposedly it was down in the river hills, down on Current River. And over the years, I'm 51 years old, and over the last 50 years, this thing has started to open up a little bit, and it has become a bit of a cave. My dad checked it with a metal detector, and we found a tin cup down inside there. But we're not allowed to dig or do anything to go farther. But supposedly there's quite a cache of silver hid in there.
Well, send me an email and tell me more about it, and we'll look into that, see if the homeowner or the landowner will let us investigate.
Quite an interesting story. So, yeah, we've got a little bit of background on that, too. But he really had a great reputation with the folks down in that part of the country where he felt safe. That was the place he came to hide.
Was he considered like a god, Ron?
Oh, I think he was a little bit larger than life. You know, he's a tall, thin, good-looking guy up on a nice horse, and he always dressed well and had his hair cut and trimmed neatly. You know, so he was just the gentleman robber and commanded a lot of respect. But I think he was also a high-ranking official in the Knights of the Golden Circle, so he commanded the respect.
Yeah.
You know, nobody would stand up against that group.
I recall a picture in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch saying, is this Jesse James' grave or not? It was something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And their theory was is that he might not have died when he was supposed to have.
Exactly. And that was the contention right from day one. They knew because there was a ruse a year earlier that this might be a fake. The detectives that came down from Kansas City didn't buy into it at all. And you got to think, you know, Sheriff Timberlake took command of the crime scene. He had no authority. He was from a county, you know, two counties away where the James Farm was. He deputized the James gang members to take possession of the body. They never let any other authority have contact with the body. It went to the James home to be buried. So it was completely under the control of the James family the entire time. Even in 1902, when they moved the grave, it was entirely done by the James family. So, you know, there was something they were covering up there.
Did he apparently stop robbing after that, after he faked this death, and then did he go straight?
Yeah, and I think maybe the real Jesse James had gone straight years before. You know, I'm thinking about how much of a love story this is and how his wife probably put her foot down and say, you're not running around with those boys anymore.
Enough is enough.
Yeah.
Let's go to Tom in Omaha, Nebraska on the wild card line. Tom, thanks for calling.
Yes. Well, I have no way of verifying this. It's family oral history. But allegedly, my great-great-grandmother was Jesse James' aunt.
Uh-huh.
Huh.
What's the family name?
Well, I don't know what her name was.
Uh-huh.
Now, my grandmother, her maiden name was Thomas. And she was from Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was younger, my mother would tell me about going down to visit Granny, and Granny would haul out the family album with the pictures of the James brothers, all the cousins, the gang, everybody.
Terrific. Love to see that. Wow.
And I don't know what happened to it. You know,
oh, my word.
But she said that every time there was a claim that Jesse James was still alive, she'd fly into a rage. She says, "Jesse's dead. I cleaned him up for his funeral. Jesse's dead."
Well, there we go with the three Jesse's theory again. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like I said, I have no way of confirming it. It's family oral history.
Well, you know, it's always fun to do genealogy. You never know what you're going to find out. So I encourage you. And then maybe you'll
get
that photo
out. There is kind of a fuzzy story attached to it. When my mother's last brother was born, my grandmother was unconscious in the hospital, and the hospital wanted to name the baby. And her father-in-law said, "Call him Jesse James." So they named my uncle Jesse James.
There's another one out there then.
When my grandmother came up and found out, she was absolutely furious.
Oh, my, yeah. Hey, I just wanted to say, George, and for Tom, too, you know, anyone who has these great stories and wants to get in touch with me, just go to my website, rjpastory.com, and send me an email. And if you're interested in more material on the book, there's the jessejamessecret.com website, too.
The organization he was part of, the KGC, does it still exist?
I think so. They announced in 1925, 26, in that time frame there, that they had disbanded, that everyone was aged.
It wasn't the KKK, was it?
Well, the original name was Ku Klux, which is closed club, and that became Ku Klux. So, yes,
that's interesting.
George, they definitely linked to the KKK. And, you know, that became a huge organization. There were 5 million members that publicly, you know, wore their colors about this group.
You know what? There still may be.
Yeah, definitely.
They're just not as vocal as they used to. I remember back in my early news days in Detroit, I would hear stories that the KKK would want to march down a street in Illinois, for example,
right.
And things like that.
Yeah.
They don't do that anymore.
And when Truman was elected president, the KKK came out in Kansas City and chided him for not publicly stating he was a member. So he came to the meeting and made a public appearance, you know.
So one day you're going to stumble across one of these caves and the cache of silver and gold, and you're going to be worth billions.
Well, you know, let's see how that goes. I'm very encouraged that, you know, we'll have some more finds and we'll do well as time goes forward. But really, the treasure is in this story. You know, if you get a chance to read the book, you know, it's really an amazing story with so many layers and characters involved, and just understanding, you know, the myth of Jesse James. It's a fabulous story. For those who are sticklers for evidence and the empirical side of this, I did a presentation for the Forensic Science Academy in 2004, and now I've made this into a 50-page document that you can get at jessejamesforensics.com, and it goes through the specific points of evidence and the forensics of the case. It really proves it out.
Great job. Where'd you get the old pictures?
This is years of archival research, meeting other people who've been digging into history, and you know, the forensics report that I just mentioned, jessejamesforensics.com, has hundreds of great photos in it, originals. I've got a timeline of Jesse with about 25 pictures from infancy to his old age.
Ron Pastore is just saying to us tonight that throughout the United States, there could be well over $1 trillion in treasure hidden away in various caves and places. It's an amazing story. Ron, thank you. The book, Jesse James' Secret. When we come back, we will talk about Satan.